About the time I began my enterprise in Rochester, I chanced to spend a night and a day under the roof of a man whose character and conversation and whose objects and aims in life made a very deep impression upon my mind and heart. His name had been mentioned to me by several prominent colored men, among whom were the Reverend Henry Higlin Garnett and J.W. Logan. In speaking of him, their voices would drop to a whisper, and what they said made me very eager to see and know him.
Every member of the family, young and old, seemed glad to see me, and I was much at home. It was a small wooden building on a back street, respectable enough, but not quite the place where one would look. Plain as was the outside of this man's house, the inside was plainer. It would take longer to tell what was not in this house than what was in it.
My first meal passed under the misnomer of tea, though there was nothing about it resembling the usual significance of that term. It consisted of
beef soup, cabbage, and potatoes.
A meal such as a man might relish after following the plow all day, or performing a forced march of a dozen miles over a rough road in frosty weather, innocent of paint, veneering, varnish, or tablecloth. The table announced itself unmistakably of the plainest workmanship. It is said that a house reflects the character of its occupants. This one certainly did. In it there were no disguises, no illusions, no make-believes. Certainly, I never felt myself in the presence of a stronger religious influence than while in this man's house.
Captain Brown cautiously approached the subject, for he seemed to apprehend opposition to his views. He denounced slavery in look and language, fierce and bitter, thought that slaveholders had forfeited their right to live, that the slaves had the right to gain their liberty in any way they could, did not believe that moral suasion would ever liberate the slave, or that political action would abolish the system.
Of the hills to freedom. They were placed here for the emancipation of the Negro race. They are full of natural forts where one man for defense will be equal to 100 for attack. They are full of places where large numbers of brave men could be concealed and elude pursuit for a long time. I know these mountains well and could take a body of men and keep them there despite all the efforts of Virginia to dislodge them. The object to be sought
want is to destroy the money value of slave property. That can only be done by rendering such property insecure. My plan is to take 25 picked men and begin on a small scale. Supply them with ammunition, post them in squads of fives on a line of 25 miles long. The most persuasive shall go down into the fields as opportunity offers and induce the slaves to join them.
He thought he could gather a force of 100 hardy men who would lead the adventurous life to which he proposed to train them. They would run off the slaves, retain the brave and strong in the mountains, and send the weak and the timid to the north by the Underground Railroad. His operations would be enlarged with increasing numbers.
How would you support these men?
I would subsist them upon the enemy. Slavery is a state of war, and the slave had a right to anything necessary to his freedom.
Suppose you succeed in running off with these slaves and impress Virginia with a sense of insecurity. The effect will be only to take them and sell their slaves further south.
Then I would follow them up. If we could drive slavery out of one county, it would be a great gain. It would weaken the system throughout the state.
But they would employ bloodhounds to hunt you out of the mountains.
That they might attempt. But the chances are we should whip them. And when we should have whipped one squad, they would be careful how they pursued.
But you might be surrounded and cut off from your provisions or means of subsistence.
That could not be done, so we could not cut our way out. But even if the worst came, I could but be killed. And I have no better use for my life than to lay it down in the cause of the slave. When I suggested that we might convert the slaveholders, he said that could never be.
He knew their proud hearts,
and that they would never give up their slaves until they felt a big stick about their heads.
And they would never give up their slaves until they felt a big stick about their heads.
He knew their proud hearts,
and that they would never give up their slaves until they felt a big stick about their heads.
The
proud hearts, and then they would never give up their slaves until they got the big stick about their heads.
From this night spent with John Brown in Springfield, Massachusetts, 1847, while I continued to write and speak against slavery, I became all the same less hopeful of its peaceful abolition. My utterances became more and more tinged by the color of this man's strong impressions. I expressed this apprehension that slavery could only be destroyed by bloodshed when I was suddenly and sharply interrupted by my good old friend Sojourner Truth with the question, "Frederick, is God dead?" "No," I answered, "and because God is not dead, slavery can only end in blood." The men who went to Kansas with the purpose of making it a free state were heroes and martyrs. One of the leaders in this holy crusade for freedom was John Brown. This brave old man and his sons were amongst the first to hear and heed the trumpet of freedom calling them to battle. The border ruffians from Missouri had openly declared their purpose not only to make Kansas a slave state, but that they would make it impossible for free state men to live there. Captain John Brown felt that now, after long years of waiting, his hour had come. And never did man meet the perilous requirements of any occasion more cheerfully, courageously, and disinterestedly than he.
The horrors wrought by Captain Brown's iron hand cannot be contemplated without a shudder. But it is the shudder which one feels at the execution of a murderer. Until the lives of tyrants shall become more precious in the sight of men than justice, John Brown will need no defender. With only 8 men, he met, fought, whipped, and captured Henry Clay Pate with 25 well-armed and well-mounted men. With just 30 men, he vanquished 500 Missourians under the command of General Reed. These men had come under an oath never to return to Missouri
till they had stamped out the last vestige of the free state spirit in Kansas. But a brush with old Brown took this conceit out of them, and they were glad to get home upon any terms.
Any terms, a brush with old Brown, they were glad to get home. Any terms, a brush with old Brown, they were glad to get home.
Before leaving Kansas, he went in full Missouri and liberated a dozen slaves in a single night. And despite laws and marshals, brought these people through a half dozen states and landed them safe in Canada.
On the night of the 16th of October, 1859, there appeared near the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah Rivers a party of 19 men, 14 white and 5 colored. These men invaded the town of Harper's Ferry.
Disarm!
property at that place.
All rested and lay prisoners of nearly all the prominent citizens in the neighborhood.
And one of them was Captain John Brown, the man who originated, planned, and commanded the expedition. At the time of capture, Captain Brown was supposed to be mortally wounded, as he had several ugly gashes and bayonet wounds on his head and body. And apprehending that he might speedily die, or that he might be rescued, and the opportunity to make of him an example of slaveholding vengeance would be lost, his captors hurried him to Charleston, placed him in prison, strongly guarded by troops, and before his wounds were healed, he was brought into court, subjected to a nominal trial, convicted of high treason and inciting slaves to insurrection, and was executed. A scream for vengeance came up from all sections of the slave states and from great multitudes in the North. All who were supposed to have been in any way connected with John Brown were to be hunted down and surrendered to the tender mercies of panic-stricken Virginia, and there to be tried after the fashion of John Brown's trial, and of course to be summarily executed. My going to England was not suggested by my connection with John Brown, but the fact that I was now in danger of arrest made what I had intended a pleasure a necessity.
Visit in 1847, our relations were confidential. He often stopped overnight when we talked over his plan for destroying the value of slave property. Men do not like to buy runaway horses, nor to invest their money in a species of property likely to take legs and walk off with itself. If the plan should fail, and John Brown driven from the mountains, a new fact would be developed by which the nation would be kept awake to the existence of slavery.
After the Kansas trouble was over and freedom was a fact in that territory, this left them with arms and men, for the men who had been with him in Kansas believed in him and would follow him in any humane but dangerous enterprise he might take.
John Brown wrote to me,
informing me a beginning would soon soon be made. And appointed an old stone quarry near Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, as our place of meeting. I approached the quarry cautiously, for John Brown was gently well armed and regarded strangers with suspicion. Rewards were offered for his arrest for offenses said to have been committed in Kansas.
We sat down among the rocks
and talked over the enterprise. The taking of Harper's Ferry was now declared as his purpose, and he wanted to know what I thought. I opposed the measure with all the arguments at my command. To me, such a measure would be fatal to all engaged. It would be an attack upon the federal government and would array the whole country against us. Captain Brown did not object to rousing the nation. It seemed that something startling was just what the nation needed.
I told him that
all of his arguments and descriptions of the place convinced me that he was going into a perfect steel trap, and that once in, he would never get out alive. He replied that if surrounded, he would find means for cutting his way out, but that would not be forced on him. He should have a number of the best citizens as his prisoner at the start. I looked at him with astonishment that he could rest upon a reed so weak and broken, and told him that Virginia would blow him and hostages sky high rather than he should hold Harper's Ferry an hour. We spent the most of Saturday and a part of Sunday in this debate. He for striking a blow which should rouse the country, and I for unaccountably drawing off the slaves to the mountains, as first suggested by him. In parting, he put his arms around me in a manner more than friendly and said, discretion, or cowardice, made me proof against the dear old man's eloquence. Perhaps it was something of both which determined my course.
Jeremiah Anderson, one of Brown's men who took part in the raid but escaped by the mountains, told me that he and Shields Green were sent out on duty as soon as the capture of the arsenal was effected. Their business was to bring in the slaves from the surrounding country and were on the outside when Brown was surrounded. I said, why did not Shields come with you?
Well, he said, I told him to come, but he simply said he must go down to the old man.
Thank you.
much of the excitement caused by the Harper's Ferry insurrection had subsided, and I should now have gratified a long-cherished desire to visit France, had not news reached me from home of the death of my beloved daughter, Annie, the light and life of my house. I took the first outgoing steamer for Portland, Maine. Great changes had now taken place in the public mind touching the raid. Virginia had satisfied her thirst for blood. She had executed all the raiders who had fallen into her hands. She had not given Captain Brown the benefit of a reasonable doubt, but hurried him to the scaffold in panic-stricken haste. She had made herself ridiculous by her fright and despisable by her fury. Emerson's prediction that Brown's gallows would become like a cross was already becoming fulfilled. The old hero in the trial hour had behaved so grandly that men regarded him not as a murderer, but as a martyr. His defeat was already assuming the form and pressure of victory, and his death was giving new life and power to the principles of justice and liberty. He had spoken great words in the face of death and the champions of slavery. He had quailed before neither. What he had lost by the sword, he had more than gained by the truth. To his own soul, he was right, and neither principalities nor powers, life nor death, things present or things to come, could shake his dauntless spirit or move him from his ground. Not even ask that the cup of death might pass from him. Those who looked for confession heard only the voice of rebuke and warning.